Mike.
Beata. So shall I just dive in?
Dive in.
All right. Well, thank you all so much for inviting me to speak at Jikoji. I always love to come here and spend time with the Sangha here. And Doug is the one who usually invites me, so I always have to tell a story on Doug, which, so I see you're digging, for one thing, so there's digging happening here that has your name on it, I know. But, you know, Doug and Joe and I went to SPOT together, the Shogaku priest ongoing training for 3 years, and one time it was really hot. It was in Fresno, you know, North Fork, north of Fresno, and very hot. And they had a pool. I was in the pool, and I had a squirt gun because that's my tradition, is the squirt gun lineage. So I had a squirt gun that shot, you know, quite a distance because I had to get the teacher when she came out of the room also. So then I was in the pool with my squirt gun, and here's Doug in his shirt and his pants and his leather shoes. And I thought, I'm just going to nail the guy. So I nailed, and he just kept walking toward it, actually, squirting at him, kept walking toward it, and then jumped in the pool with his shoes, his clothes, everything. And I just fell in love. I said, "This, I love this guy. This is my kind of guy that just jumps in to whatever's happening on a moment's notice." So thank you for that. I always remember that. It's actually a deep teaching. Move toward and jump in. Really sweet. So I gave a talk about a month or so ago at Santa Cruz Zen Center, where I did most of my training and practice. And I touched on how in my own practice I had in some ways traded off work. In other words, I had chosen work over practice opportunities because I lived in this house there that required support. I mean, I had to pay for it. I had to pay, you know, to support my life there. And it was probably my life was a little bit bigger than I could actually sustain as one person. When I bought the house, I was not alone, and, you know, things changed, and I tried to hold up this lifestyle I had there. And a lot of things changed for me, my work and so on. But in any case, in this talk, I spoke about how I felt I had traded off, in some cases, practice for in favor of marketplace work. And this woman in the group, in the Sangha there, who I'd never met, very shyly asked me why I made a distinction between work and practice. And it's a great question, and I have heard this question many times. In fact, the first time I came to practice, I was in Southern California, my Zumi Roshi's lineage, when I started practice, and I came to a workshop called Zen at Work, which by Shishin Wick, one of my Zumi's heirs, and he said, someone asked him, okay, so at the end, in the end, how do I do it? You know, how do I take my practice to my work? And he said, see every person as Buddha, hear every sound as Dharma, and reveal every location as Nirvana. And of course, I just got chills and I was so moved, and then I went back to work. So I'm much better at revealing every location as Nirvana when the location happens to be my living room. And, you know, then I step out my door and I go into the marketplace. And, you know, so I frankly had been sort of bored with this question most of my time in Zen. People would ask this and I would just think, what is the question here? There's no choice. You have to work to support your life and you have to practice. I mean, so we just do our best to bring our practice into our everyday lives and make them seamless things. And I never really thought, I mean, I thought about it, but I didn't really focus on it or hone in on it as a practice question, because to me it was a choiceless choice. This is just what we do. And then in giving this talk at Santa Cruz, I was really struck by this woman's question. And what is the distinction I'm making in my mind? And is it real? You know, is there some external validation for this distinction? And exactly what is the distinction I'm making? And what I ended up saying to her, because she pressed me, she's like, well, you're making a distinction. She just kept saying that to me. And of course, I saw that in my words, but I couldn't figure out on the fly there where this came together for me and where it didn't come together. So I don't think that when we say things are one, that we mean they're identical or they're the same. I don't think we mean that. So this brought up a certain, you know, kind of discomfort in me, because I realized, oh, I am making distinctions, and maybe I don't need to. Maybe they're not real. So the woman asked me at that point, when I was at Santa Cruz, she asked me for my email, and I gave it to her, and she sent me an email, which I have here. I'm trying to find the very first one. We've had quite a dialogue since then, and these are our emails in front of me. So the first time she emailed me, she said she was talking about how it felt to her like a contradiction to separate work and practice. And versus, she says, contradiction between work and formal, in parentheses, practice. So formal practice. So what does that mean? I started thinking, well, so there's a distinction between formal and informal practice. So what is that? And then she says, further, it seems to me, and this was really interesting to me, nobody has ever said this in exactly this way. Further, it seems to me that there is quite a demand from practitioners to attend, and thus for you to hold meditation retreats more often than you are able to meditate. So she's saying, you know, I mean, I think she's saying, you set up this practice so that it is in opposition to work, by simply having this requirement that people do it maybe more often than they are able to. So I had just never heard that way of putting that before. And she said, she's asking why. Why does it feel so different when I sit and when I don't? Then she goes on to tell me about her yoga teacher. So her concern is not really practice and work being one. It's more about why does she crave sitting? As it comes out in her email, she says, you know, I want to believe that they're the same, but I crave time on my cushion. So I had completely misheard her original question, which I thought, why does I have to sit on the cushion if I work? And what she was really saying is, why do I still want to sit on my cushion when I'm practicing at work? And for her, her work is very much heart practice and very much about her practice as she understands it. And my teacher, Catherine at Santa Cruz, had always said that to me. You know, don't distinguish between what your work and your practice, and then you're always practicing, and just bring that mind to your work. And that made a lot of sense to me. At the same time, there's always been a pull to sit sessions, to sit in the morning before going to work, and so forth. So what is that? You know, essentially, we're filling more than 24 hours in a day. if I sat every morning, every evening, sessions regularly, off work, so work doesn't always, you know, love that. So then she tells me about her yoga teacher, who told her that if you don't feel any different before you do an hour of practice than you do after your hour of practice, then you'll know you've advanced. So she has now a little wish to advance, or to maybe know how to advance. And I think that's a marketplace idea, that we advance. Hey, I've been here 5 years, I should get a promotion. Shouldn't I have gotten that promotion? You know, it's a lot about advancement and in the marketplace. So the difficulty I have not distinguishing is that Zen, Zazen, our practice is at its core about no gaining idea. And the marketplace is about what I have to sell and what you'll pay for it. So it's an exchange mentality. And almost true no matter what I've done. I've done many things in my career. I've been a consultant for most of my career and as an outsider, so not working internally in an organization, but selling my work to clients, executive clients for the most part, organizational clients. And so I'm selling something. So therefore, I have to package it so that I think they'll see value in it. Therefore, I have to know what their value equation is and try to position my offering so that it fits their value equation and they pay for what I'm offering. That's a very different mind than when I come into the Zendo and I have no gaining idea, no thought of who's ahead of who or who's better than who, anything. I mean, I might have those thoughts, but they're going to pass quickly. And I'm just sitting here. And I've been doing this for 23 years, and I'll keep doing this until I die. Without, you know, regardless of what it brings me or what I attain or whatever happens, it's just what I do. And I realize, she says, and she's talking about yearning for formal practice. So you asked me yesterday or maybe the day before, and I wasn't there yesterday, what title I would give this talk. And what I said, I think Zazen and work. Because when he asked me to pin it down, I had to take up this question of what do I mean by practice? And I think we can practice anywhere in the largest sense of the term practice, and that is our lives. And I remember last time I was here, Michael, you talked about Koban's term for sitting samadhi and taking sitting samadhi to walking samadhi, and you referred to it as why you don't do housekeeping in between, which, you know, in my lineage, we do housekeeping in between. We get up and we clean up our seat and everything, then we all stand and wait until everyone's standing. Then we turn and start ginhin. And it's always shocking to my body when that doesn't happen. So people just get up and start walking. And I'm like, oh, it just reminds me, oh, this is a different form here. What was the word? He's had a term for sitting samadhi.
Sitting samadhi is za, like zazen, uh-huh. Za-jo, and the jo means samadhi.
Okay.
So sitting samadhi becomes
walking samadhi?
Becomes, yeah, ritsu-jo, which is standing samadhi.
Oh,
ritsu,
got it.
Ritsu-jo, standing samadhi, and then ritsu-jo becomes ho-jo, which is kind of moving samadhi. And I think he meant that not just to be kinhin, but any kind of movement, so work would be included.
Right.
Would be a samadhi.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So
ideally, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, in its perfection of practice, it would be bringing a samadhi. It would be always samadhi, always samadhi. So that's, I mean, that's really interesting to me. That what that does is it links the three as one whole. So it's not like my life is divided between practice, you know, sitting, standing, and walking, but in fact, that's all part of one whole. It's just a whole activity that is our lives. We sit together. Is that right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to add that there's one more samadhi.
Oh.
It's called, everyone loves this one, it's called Kajo. Kajo is lying down samadhi.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Actually, I sometimes lie down for zazen. And I teach people to lie down for zazen. And so these are the four noble positions, standing, sitting, walking, and lying down. And you know, in the Metta Sutta, it says, you know, practicing in all these ways, you know, standing, whether standing, sitting, walking, or lying down, we are bringing our whole selves to this and studying the self. So the practice underlying all of this, it seems to me, is the study of the self, turning the lamp inward, noticing how I arise in, you know, in different causes and conditions, and then trying to loosen the grip on that I, whatever that I is that's arising. And, of course, work is prime ground, you know, because, boy, a lot of I's arise in a day at work. So it is a fantastic opportunity to study the arising of the self, And even the way the self hardens and becomes solid, and then I begin to defend a point of view as if my identity, you know, my survival relies on it or something. So, I mean, I think it's all fertile ground. However, I will say that for me, a day of working at my workplace does feel different than a day of sitting zazen in the zendo. They are different activities, even though at their root, they are one activity, which is studying the self. And that is our practice. So I think that we don't sit to achieve something. And this is the hard thing to grasp, is we sit, because it almost makes sitting silly in some ways, if we fully grasp that we aren't sitting to understand anything or to know something, or to be able to, you know, chant sutras, or to be able to even sit still. I mean, we sit because we are Buddha, and that's what Buddhas do. Buddhas sit. So we already are what we're looking for when we sit down. And I sit to sort of remember my body-mind, remember it, put its members back together so that I remember what this really is, this body-mind, and that it is not separate, no matter what it's doing, whether we're walking kinhin or going up for a meal or using the restroom or going off to work. It really is the same practice at its core. But which is the practice of studying the self. And I believe, for me, I could not bring that practice to the hubbub of the marketplace where I'm buying and selling and negotiating and how can I make a living and, you know, navigating on the conventional realm. I couldn't bring a non-attaining mind to that realm on an everyday basis if I were not sitting still in the zendo once or twice, or at my home once or twice a day. I don't think I could sustain it. I would just, like most people, get, you know, whipped into the rush of the marketplace river and find myself downstream somewhere going, how did I get here? How did I get more angry than I was? Or how did I get less tolerant than I was? Or how did I manage to become burned out, using up all my reserve for one thing and forget that I have the wholeness of this standing, sitting, walking, and lying down. So the best analogy I could find for her was that in my life, practice, or zazen, I'm going to say, more specifically than practice, zazen and marketplace and my work in the marketplace are like hand and glove. The hand without a glove might be a cold hand, but it's a hand. A glove without a hand is empty. It has no function, essentially. So I need both. I need both in order to sustain this samadhi, or even if I wouldn't even use those words necessarily, because again, that borders into her yoga teacher's comment, which is that if you feel the same before and after you've attained something, and I would say if you really feel the same exact way before and after, there's something you're not in touch with. Because I rarely feel the same from one moment to the next. I mean, a lot of causes and conditions affect how I feel. So I could feel, you know, better or worse at the beginning of zazen and the end of zazen. I could think I had a terrible zazen period and get up full of loving kindness for all my sangha mates. So I don't think I get to be the judge of better or worse, essentially. It's just what it is in the moment. Then when I start comparing my moments, I might say, oh, I feel better now. I just sat. Or, wow, that was torturous period of zazen and I'm exhausted, you know. I mean, I've had it go both ways. So, and, you know, it just waxes and wanes, just like all human energy, just like our energy does. So I think there are ways that we can talk about this practice and work thing that sort of set up false dichotomy between them, but I also would say that they are different activities, and they serve each other in a sense. So I have learned as I've gone away from Santa Cruz, I now live in San Mateo and I've started a sitting group there, and I'm realizing that something I just never thought of, never occurred to me, which is that most people coming there to sit, these are brand new sitters, they're just, you know, learning, they see it on Meetup and they come. They're there to get out of pain. They're there to try to be more comfortable in this land of birth and death, loss after loss after loss. And they would like me to tell them how to be more comfortable in samsara. And I want to tell them that because then they'll come back. If they think this is a place they can get something that gives them relief, then they'll more likely come back. The problem is, if I tell them that, I would be lying. It's simply not been my experience. I do think that this sitting practice, this zazen, is medicine. And but for me, in my own practice, it's not a it's a medicine I keep taking. It's not a medicine I take and it cures my disease of perceived separateness, and then I don't have to take the medicine anymore. I don't think that we can get more comfortable in samsara. I think we can to a certain point, but then someone we love dies, or our house burns down, or something we cared about disappears from our property. You know, somebody robs our truck and takes the whatever it is that we loved in there. Or we lose the job that we thought was sustaining our lives. Or we lose the zendo or the teacher that we thought was the only one who ever saw us. And all of these experiences remind me that it really isn't possible to get more comfortable here, even though I try. I want to. So if we look at our marketplace work in that way, that we go to it without gaining idea, just to bring ourselves fully to our lives, then we are practicing there and being willing to be deformed there, to not look the way I think I should, to have other people misperceive me, misconstrue me, take my words in some completely odd way that I was not anticipating and come back to me with anger or come back to me with a bad evaluation of what I did, you know, if they're my boss and I care about that. So if we can, you know, so to the extent that we can hold this mind of practice in all those pulls and draws and energies, I think that there is no distinction. And I just haven't arrived there yet. I need the glove in order to feel, in order to be at my work in a and at my everyday life with that mind. And then even within that, there's waxing and waning, just like in zazen. I mean, I guess I just don't experience a solid state of mind. So it's hard for me to sort of speak about what her yoga teacher said, which is kind of what I said back to her. I don't know. I don't have that framework to speak from. So I'm curious what this all brings to your minds and how you work with this livelihood, this support of body, mind, and this zazen, this practice, which is the heart of what you do here. Any thoughts about it?
I'm very thankful that you've shared this, because stuff that I thought about a lot, and you were right on target saying, I didn't deal with it. Oh, yeah, that's good. But don't want to stop the flow, because it was just all good. And I want to briefly summarize sort of to make it even clearer.
Great.
There's one, I think what the yoga teacher was saying, I think you're talking about yoga postures, hatha yoga.
And then this woman says,
what
she
that means with that, because I used to do that also. It's very, very good, especially mm-hmm. very helpful for zazen, for meditating, because your body is prepared then to be able to comfortably, mm-hmm. you know, you're saying comfortably and get rid of your pain, like the people, yeah, that's, you use the yoga to do that to sit.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's with the, you know you're advanced, that there's no difference between you, but that means you're so good. You've gotten to the point where you're consciously able to release the tension in your body that always builds up from psychological tension.
Mm-hmm.
It builds up as physical tension in your muscles. And mm-hmm. the yoga deliberately releases that tension at the same time doing certain mental things where you're affirming and you're releasing its it's cognate in your mind.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So you release mm-hmm. it all. Now, if mm-hmm. you get really good at it, you start living in it all the time.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
that you didn't really need to relax. You did mm-hmm. your routine anyway, but you're living in, you're staying relaxed. That's what mm-hmm. I think that mm-hmm. really means. It's
yeah.
different from
yeah.
what it's different from what you're talking about with meditation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is the big problem that everyone I've thought about for a long time also working. And you're right, they both are a dharmic activity, you know, they're both practice, but they're two separate things that you're really doing.
Mm-hmm.
And without the sitting part, eventually you get very frayed and
mm-hmm.
things really sort of fall apart in the work part. And if you could sort of minimize or remove them entirely the work, and that was okay, that would be a good thing, I think. I mean, there's monks and nuns that do that.
Mm-hmm.
So, I haven't come up with a solution, I mean,
mm-hmm.
myself.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking back in different work environments, I think, especially when I was young, you were just sort of considered not very, not of great, they didn't think much, you know, well, there's that young guy, you know, whatever. They weren't getting much respect, I
mm-hmm.
guess might be one way to put it.
Mm-hmm.
So I found it in that sense rather difficult, and that was in a formal corporate environment, Silicon Valley,
mm-hmm.
and they have, you know, good rules, but everything. But there's no way that type of, you know, I'd have to be somebody Japanese, come over from Japan, still practicing in that Japanese mindset, which I think your advice came from a Japanese Zen teacher or something. So that I can see that a Japanese person, yeah. But we're American.
He was American.
Huh? Okay.
All my teachers have been American.
Okay, well, anyway, that sounds to me very much like...
Yeah, coming from that.
And it would work. It would probably work with Japanese in their culture, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I could see, I would imagine. However, this is America. It's
mm-hmm.
a little different.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't find that those types of very good things would work particularly in quite a number of work environments I was in. You just sort of... It boiled down to even simpler. You just were aware of your thoughts... You know, you
mm-hmm.
kept that going, and you focused on. If you're totally focused on what you're doing, you don't even notice the time going by.
Mm-hmm.
And 8 hours? Oh, okay, great. I get to go home.
Mm-hmm.
And then everything else, you try and deal with whatever comes up as you can, and then basically get home and meditate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I thought that was very good. I just wanted to summarize and make a
mm-hmm.
few comments on that.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I haven't myself done a lot of yoga, so I appreciate that. And she did say that she was, she thought the teacher was talking about holding asanas or positions and the
you're
ability
always,
to do that.
You're always
yeah.
in this natural, it's a
so,
wonderful feeling. Your
relaxed,
body is very relaxed.
Yeah.
Just everything about the way you walk and go around
yeah.
for about an hour or so after doing the yoga postures.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then if you get really advanced,
yeah.
you have it all
yeah.
the time.
It just never, there's no distinction. I think... thank you for the summary as well. There are monks and nuns who do
full-time cultivators.
Yeah, full-time, formal, let's say. Because zazen is not our only practice. It's the heart of our practice. But we also walk in the zendo, we chant in the zendo, we bow. These are all trainings. These are all training opportunities. You know, we eat in the zendo during long retreats or in the dining room silently. This is all training the mind to turn back on itself and study the self in various conditions and so on. So... and maybe my work is a little more people-oriented than yours. I'm in human resources and organization development, so I'm often in situations where somebody's mad at somebody else. This seems to be my life. So for me to hold, to be really stable in that, you know, day after day after day, seeing that side of people's expression, it's more stability than I could muster without Zazen, probably before and after, but certainly in the early morning.
Oh.
Are we done?
Oh, no.
Oh.
No, I was just going to say something.
Please.
Are you done?
Yeah.
Well, thank you for your talk. It reminded me of a talk I heard from Okamura Roshi about, was based on Kurosawaki. Basically, he and it kind of shows us that this is not this situation
mm-hmm.
of so-called practice and so-called everyday life.
Mm-hmm.
How to integrate those are not unique to our mm-hmm. just our situation. He told the story of Jesus coming into the temple and noticing that there was business going on in mm-hmm. the temple. There were merchants and they were selling stuff, and the whole place had gotten turned into a marketplace. And it was, and he got really angry, and he drove them out.
Mm-hmm.
And the temple of practice, or the temple of life, should not be a place for merchants.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
he talked about a merchant mentality.
Mm-hmm.
And I think sometimes, and he also told the story of that Meister Eckhart, I think it was. Meister Eckhart told a story of Jesus driving it out, and he said the temple, of course there's the physical temple, but the real temple is our minds, our body and minds. So in our, as he told it from Meister Eckhart, we have within us a merchant mentality
mm-hmm.
of gaining ideas. We want to get better. We want more. We want approval from others. We want that.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, the temple itself, the temple of practice, or the temple of awareness, or the temple of our consciousness, should be empty, should be clean of that merchant mentality
mm-hmm.
in order to really be a temple. So that
mm-hmm.
very interesting that came up, and you know that kind of your talk reminded
mm-hmm.
me of that.
That's exactly it. So can you bring this temple,
yeah.
into that the marketplace where there is? It's all about exchange and value. You know,
right.
who has more value and who's higher, and what has value, and bring this temple there. And stay in the temple.
Yeah.
It's very compelling out there. Yeah, be the temple essentially, and still be engaging in the conventional realm with everyone in the marketplace. This is the Bodhisattva's work, actually, and so to separate the you know one temple from another, or to separate the work from practice is. You know, is a pretty precarious bodhisattva, not understanding that we're always one thing. So also at Aya Ananda Bodhi, who's one of the bhikkhunis that was ordained a couple years ago, they left Ajahn Chah's lineage because they refused to ordain women. And these five bhikkhunis left Ajahn Chah's lineage in order to be ordained by a monk secretly in the night. And now three of them live in San Francisco, and I've had a wonderful chance to have a relationship with one of them and to visit with her. And the very first time I visited with her, she said, "We want to be monastics." Now, they wear, okay, so all the time, they're Tibetan nuns, ordained Tibetan nuns, you know, buzzed hair, the whole nine. And she said, "We want to be monastics, Beata, but our rent is really high." And so we always, we can't say no to anything. Somebody calls and wants us to speak, we have to go speak because we need the Donna. You know? I mean, it's very interesting. So here's a nun living for who knows how long in England, in Ajahn Chah's monastery, where everything is, you know, present and provided by, I don't know how it's set up, but she wasn't working per se, except within the monastic environment. She leaves to be ordained because that's what's required of her, and then finds herself not able to be a monastic, essentially, because she has to support the home. So that was exactly my conundrum. And I mean, I hear this everywhere. It's really an attractive separation sort of to make, or a seductive separation to make. And in some ways, you have to acknowledge that, yes, Aya Nandabodhi is not able to spend as much time in monastic practice as would be nice, because she does have to support this home. So it's all, the question seems to me is always begged. I saw a couple hands. Joe, did you have a comment?
I get one comment from conversation on a regular basis, which goes, my job, whatever it is not right livelihood, so therefore I can't really practice there, and so I need to change my job so I can practice in my everyday life. I was wondering how you respond to that conversation.
I think this is it has some complexity in it that's hard to address without a person, you know, whose context I could understand. I think sometimes I sit in the Zendo and think, these thoughts I'm having are not Zazen thoughts, and so I can't practice, you know. So I think the mind does draws a lot of lines that don't necessarily need to be drawn about what's good and bad and right and wrong. On the other hand, you know, I mean, I don't know. I there could be a situation where someone is as part of their job, trading off ethical an ethical life. They're sort of sacrificing what they believe is right to produce something for someone else. So I don't know what that would be. I mean, the thing that comes to mind is, you know, just killing animals for the sake of killing them, not because we're going to eat them or use them or work or we need that sustenance to support our lives, but just to kill. I mean, I might have to say to the person, well, that's probably a worthy question about what is right livelihood. If you go home at night feeling, you know, slimy for what you did all day, I might wonder, what is that? Is it a fit for your actual being there? But I don't know. There's probably no objective right answer to it. I would just engage the person. Are they just drawing lines within their mind that they draw the same way sitting on their cushion here with different material? Or is there some, you know, something in their work that is causing them to have to trade off what they feel is, an authentic way of being or an authentic life? Then I would question that. I would ask them to question that. Thank you. It's a good question.
My experience is somewhat different than yours, in that I actually do feel more comfortable in life, and I attribute it to practice. The other thing is, you've differentiated practice and work, but there's a lot more stuff that happens in my life and work. And though I do understand your point about the merchant mentality and not bring that into the temple, as it were, I find it the thing that's a little bit odd is that we seem to do everything we can to keep the world out of practice, not the other way around. So we're sitting in, you know, we want to make sure that people walk around the Zendo in the back way so they don't crunch on the gravel by the front. or we don't want to sit next to that person that shakes or swallows or does stuff like that. As someone who doesn't work 40 hours a week, so that was my first thought, is yes, I can see, and I've done work like yours, how it would be really difficult to stay mindful or present sometimes or bring practice in when you're mediating or you're in the middle of relating to people. I've done work that seems easier to bring practice into, mm-hmm. like cleaning rooms, mm-hmm. for instance. I was somewhere where I practiced and then I went and cleaned rooms, and boy, that was pretty easy to transfer that. But what does that mean, if it was really easy to do? I mean, you don't really get that. But there's a lot of other, my point is there's a lot of other stuff than work. There's mm-hmm. dealing with your family, there's preparing food, there's sitting on the bus, there's holding doors open. And I have found it somehow more possible for, if you mean by practice, I'm not 100% sure what you mean when you, by the word practice. If you mean mindfulness or no gaining idea and you're in the world, I found it more available to me when I'm not working, but I'm still in the world and I'm not here. So maybe you could, do you mean by practice, what do you mean by that when you say?
Well, I think that's the core question here. Is what do I mean? What does she mean? This person questioning me. But I think, so I had to narrow that down. And for the sake of this talk, in order to understand a big distinction between work, my activity at work and my activity in the Zendo, I defined it for the sake of this talk as Zazen. So I took a very narrow definition of the word practice. And that's where distinction begins for me. Anything other than that, if we're talking about turning toward the self, being mindful, taking in more of the circumstance, which is Zazen mind out in the world, you know, being aware of more, being stable enough to take in more, that's all practice to me. Being willing to sit by the person who swallows or shakes is practice to me. Allowing myself to sit next to that person and be deformed by their breathing and shaking or swallowing. Literally have to come up against this solid thing and have it be deformed, have it not be this solid thing anymore. That's all practice. And that can happen with a contentious supervisor, a contentious, you know, anywhere mm-hmm. that I am bringing that mind to. And I agree with you. I think that there are many, many things we do in the day that are not, quote, Zazen, or are not in the Zendo.
Let's or say. Not work. Is what I
or
mean.
Are not work. Not right, exactly. Work. Yeah, yeah. And how do I pay attention to the fact that someone I don't know is coming next and hold the door? Or do I just la-la and go through the door and let it close? It's all meaningful.
And that's not, that's the, maybe that's, where we begin. Maybe that's an opportunity. I mean, sure, we
yes.
want to be mindful and bring practice into work, but maybe we want to start when we're on the bus or when we're
yeah.
walking down the
totally.
Street or when we walk through the door of our home.
Yeah.
I mean, we walk through the door of our home, when you transition at that very moment, if there's an opportunity, there's a shift, there's an opportunity to pay attention right there.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to mention about being more comfortable in the world. I've noticed it, and this is a hard word for me to say, in that I've become more equanimous or
mm-hmm.
have a greater sense of equanimity
mm-hmm.
in my life.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I would say I'm more comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Things still bother me, but not to the extent that they once did.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's just something that happened. I just, you know, I wasn't aiming for it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The other thing you said was, you said there's no gaining, you like Zazen because there's no, I don't know what you said, gaining mind or no purpose or no goal or aim. And you said, I sit Zazen to the body and mind, you know, you said something about.
Remember. Mm-hmm.
So that's the gaining idea right there.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're all, I don't know how that happens occasionally. maybe we find ourselves sitting in this kendo without a gaining idea, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. we're walking through the door every single time with a gaining idea, aren't we? Or
I don't think necessarily.
No?
I frankly don't think about why I sit, because I gave up that question years ago. It just became I kept asking it for the first few years of practice. Frankly, I hated Zazen for the first 16 years of my practice. And I'm very clear when that shifted. But I was at war with Zazen. And I felt like Zazen was at war with me. And Sawaki talks about this. He says, let Zazen drag you around and throw you around. And, you know, he uses those terms. I love Kodo Sawaki because he just lays it down. He's not being, like, holy about Zazen. And then you go out in the world and you get dragged around. He says he's dragged around everywhere. Let Zazen do that to you, too. So there's no distinction between Zazen, you know. I guess no gaining idea. I mean, I don't know. I don't think about that much. It was just the context of this question that brought that up for me. I do think that gaining idea is required in the marketplace. It's in order to, in my work, you know, in order to get the contract, hold my own, show up with my CEO client and continue to offer something to him that he wants to buy at $200 and a quarter an hour, you know, that's something. I mean, I have to really bring that. And he has an expectation. So we are entering that room together with a shared marketplace mentality. He's going to get something, I'm going to give something, and I'm going to get something. So we're both going to gain, and we know it. When I come in to sit Zazen, I don't know, maybe I'll be more equanimous at the end, but maybe I'll sit and you know, feel dragged around and thrown around and by Zazen. And that's okay, too. I'll still go and sit down.
Why do you keep, if you haven't gotten anything out of it, like you said,
that's why I had to drop why.
Why the heck are you here?
Drop why. Drop the why question. That's what finally I realized, is that this is like my bones and my blood. I can't not have it in my, you know, I need my bones and blood to be here intact, right? I need Zazen to be here intact. But that doesn't mean it's all beautiful and uplifting all the time. It is what it is, and I am there bringing myself fully with my hate, my rage, my wishing it were different, and my compassion, love, big-heartedness, right? So I think Zazen makes space for more, and I can experience maybe more of myself because I'm not being pulled by other energies, you know. And I think that that's the reason we reduce sensory input in Zazen, and we don't want extraneous, sound if we can do something about it, you know, because we want to come into ourselves and experience ourselves wholly. And it's a very complex thing going on right here on this chair or this cushion. So, and not always easy to show up for when it's, I don't like how it looks. I want Zazen to be holy and spiritual, but in fact, it drags me around and throws me against the wall. And that's a good thing. See, I'm up for that. But I have to stop asking, why do I do this? Because if I ask that, I'm just crazy. And maybe that's true, but let's not settle on that too fast. You know, and I could give reasons why I continued to sit Zazen. But if I apply a logical analysis to it, it does not make any sense to me in my own, if for myself.
Thank you for this. I think that maybe the no gaining idea in terms of the workplace is the core, and so thank you for bringing that idea here. I struggle with that as well. I think we all do. In terms of at work, we want to make something happen. Right?
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, that's a good. That's a great way to put it.
Yeah, and so, but clearly, I also understand that really we make nothing happen. Mm-hmm. Right, it's mm-hmm. not up to us. Mm-hmm. In my work, I certainly have experiences, big and small, of something that happened because life wanted it to happen. Right, that I'm an instrument. So I try this in terms of like holding intentions lightly. Right, because ultimately, at the workplace or wherever in life, it's not so different from here. It's mm-hmm. like I'm just here. You know, I will do the best I can, but then have things come through me. I'm the instrument. But it's very, very difficult, and I struggle with it all the time of how to hold something lightly enough
yeah.
that I'm not getting into the way, right?
Right.
And but I'm there enough to support it, right?
Right.
I'm there playing my role as best as I can.
Yeah.
So, I think perhaps I think I need to sit with this in terms of the no gaining idea
mm-hmm.
Of not maybe approaching work more like here where I have
mm-hmm.
no intention or very, very light intention.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder if you have additional thoughts on sort of how to hold intentions really lightly. Because clearly, you know, especially as a consultant, and I've done that as well, you're in control, right, in that way. Like,
mm-hmm.
you are managing the situation, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, but how to do that as lightly as possible, I think is something I'm looking to learn.
Yeah, especially when in the back of your mind you know that your client wants it to come out a certain way. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but you're agreeing to that, right?
Yes, I am. That's right. Exactly. So now that is mine
right,
to
exactly.
sort of, as you said, make something happen.
Mm-hmm.
And and I think if I stand there thinking Beata's livelihood depends on this, I better jump through any hoop to get this outcome so that Beata gets paid, right? And Beata can pay her mortgage and what have you. And that's really getting wrapped in the gaining idea. I think it's all about the softness with which I am able at times to hold Beata, right? And what Beata worries about. So if I can hold that eye lightly and just sort of trust a larger thing happening, like you said, life is happening through me and I just don't want to be in the way. Then I can have a lot of equanimity. And then there are times when Beata gets big. And she cares about this. And boy, she thinks if this doesn't happen this way, she is not going to survive. She's going to not be able to do what is needed in the world. Then you see, for me, a more solid reactivity, a less equanimous response. So I'm always wanting to watch for the signs of Beata getting hard, a little hard heart or a little hard diaphragm, right? And then say, okay, let's have a little less Beata here and just be here. And you described that beautifully. So I think that's the core of it. And yet, I also think, and I don't know, this is where I hurt myself, I think. Well, but if Beata shows up and has a big reaction, she gets mad or she tells somebody off because they're doing something that she thinks is in the way of her goal, does that mean, actually, does that reaction mean that there's a solid actor back there named Beata who's doing this? No, not really. So I don't know how I'd convince the other party of that, but it doesn't mean that. And what I do when I have those reactions is I make myself solid and I punish myself. I want to say, that was awful. That was bad. You should never do that. You know, making Beata bigger and more solid. This is my crux right here. Is can I release the grip on that Beata that arises there and just have a softer presence with that? And the jury's out. I mean, I'm still working with it. Sometimes I can, as you described, and sometimes I've given away too much of my reserve and my energy can't sustain it. And my ability to be stable without Beata gets weaker. So that, hence, I need to return to the cushion. So, but without any idea that returning to the cushion will make me better at work, because I've not found that, actually. Anyway, it's all, it puts me right in the face of this life we are living, which is this life on this cycle of birth and death. And I guess, you know, Dogen said we shouldn't wander too far from birth, breath, and death. And maybe if I had that foremost in my mind when I went to work in the morning, it would help me. hold less tightly onto what is happening on a moment-by-moment basis. But thank you, Paul.